The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
You deserve a moment to yourself every single day. And a delicious bite of a Keebler Sandies can give you that comforting pause. Relax this Sunday with a little moment to yourself and the melt-in-your-mouth magic of a Keebler Sandies. This magic is baked into simple shortbread cookies by Ernie and the Keebler Elves. So as life continues to fly by, make the most of your me moment. Take a pause and enjoy a Keebler Sandies.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Where Were You in 92 is a production of iHeartRadio.
Katie Lang's voice, I mean, like, you never had a voice like that before. You needed her voice and you needed her partnership with that songwriter. When you get all these things together, it's unstoppable. No one can say no. Because when humanity sees it, the truth, they say yes. Okay, yes.
Welcome to Where Were You in 92? A podcast in which I, your host, Jason Lanfier, look back at the major hits, one-hit wonders, shocking news stories, and irresistible scandals that shape what might be the wildest, most eclectic, most controversial 12 months of music ever. The year of big butt anthems, achy breaky hearts, and Madonna's sex book. The year that Boyz II Men and Whitney Houston shattered Billboard chart records, while George Michael, U2, and TLC confronted the AIDS crisis head-on. The year that introduced us to grunge, G-funk, and Right Said Fred. Featuring interviews with critics, obsessives, industry bigwigs, directors, producers, and the artists themselves, this series poses the question, what was it about 1992 that made it so groundbreaking, so riotous, so fun, and so batshit crazy? This week, a tale of two queer anthems, both of which tackled profound yearning and unrequited lust. One became ubiquitous while essentially hiding its homoerotic themes in plain sight. The other served as a launchpad for a celebrated but disenchanted country singer to cross over to pop and finally come out, blazing a trail for countless future artists. Sophie B. Hawkins dominated airwaves with her debut single, Damn, I Wish I Was Your Lover. And while it bore strong lesbian overtones that were rare for mainstream pop at the time, they went unnoticed to many listeners. Meanwhile, Katie Lang's hit Constant Craving ushered her out of Nashville and into the top 40 spotlight. After she came out that same year, some radio stations banned her music and picketers protested her Grammy nominations. Nevertheless, her star quickly rose, with Vanity Fair tapping her for one of its most memorable covers, and David Bowie declaring that she was, quote, fast emerging as the classiest, most stylish performer of the 90s. In this episode, we explore how both Hawkins and Lang navigated the music industry and their sexual orientations as they were thrust into the public eye. It is one of the best magazine covers of all time. It's certainly my favorite. I know, remember magazines? Once upon a time, before TikTok and Insta and Twitter, they were the indicator of cool, a way to announce that someone had truly arrived. By August of 1993, Katie Lang had arrived. There the singer was on the cover of Vanity Fair, reclining in a barber chair, wearing a pinstripe suit and a big fat tie, her hair short and her face slathered in shaving cream, as Cindy Crawford in a slinky black one-piece took a straight razor to her neck, the supermodel's eyes closed and her plump red lips parted as she tilted her head toward the heavens as if in the throes of ecstasy. Shot by Herb Ritts, the image was a subversive twist on a classic Norman Rockwell Saturday Evening Post scene. But more important, it was a dismantling of gender roles, of the idea of gender itself. It was whimsical and sensual, funny and horny, inventive and provocative, the epitome of cool. It's difficult to articulate just how edgy that cover was at the time. Literally edgy, given how Lang was on the razor's edge in the photo, but also because she'd reached a precarious point in her career, having decided to come out publicly the year before, just months after releasing her latest album, Ingenue. That choice was a bold move. It was Lang walking up to the edge of a cliff, teetering on the precipice, not knowing if or when she might fall. In 1992, Lang wasn't just the only openly lesbian pop singer. She was one of the only openly queer singers, period. But despite the rampant sexism and homophobia of that era, despite the Canadian artist's refusal to adhere to gender norms, people loved her. Judging by the impressive record sales and accolades that poured in after she came out, Lang's disclosure hardly seemed to tarnish her career. Anchored by meticulous production and Lang's angelic vocals, Ingenue went double platinum in the US and Canada and platinum in the UK. Its lead single, Constant Craving, was her first to crack the top 40, later winning a Grammy for Best Female Pop Vocal Performance, with its video snagging an MTV Video Music Award for Best Female Video. In 1992, Lang became a star. With that Vanity Fair cover, she became a sex symbol. Whether she wanted it or not, she was now associated with the lesbian chic movement, a loaded and controversial term even then. But she also became an icon and a role model, proof that you could defy the establishment and still have it embrace you. It wasn't always this way. As a country singer, Lang was an outsider. Though she'd won two Grammys and the adoration of many of her musical peers and devoted fans, she hadn't achieved the success she was seeking, or thought she was seeking. After years spent hustling in the country scene, she decided it was time to move on. While her newfound fame came with its own set of burdens, in pop music, Lang found a home. Lang was born in Edmonton, Alberta, but her family moved to Consort when she was a baby. She grew up on the Canadian prairies with her mother, two older sisters, and an older brother. Her father left the family when she was 12. But she didn't get serious about music until college, when she became infatuated with Patsy Cline, so infatuated that she believed herself to be the reincarnation of the country legend, and after graduating, formed a Cline tribute band, the Reclines. Cline was a brash, blunt performer who sported cowgirl outfits and boots. Lang admired not only her singing, but her whole look. When she established the Reclines in 1983, rather than opt for a towering updo and a pretty ladylike dress, Lang took a page from Cline's book, then cranked it up to 11. Rocking short, spiky hair, retro glasses without lenses, plastic skirts with toys dangling from them, and sawn-off cowboy boots. She wore little to no makeup and was hardly demure. Her performances with the Reclines were histrionic and outlandish, with Lang, decked out in her dime store duds, manically running across the stage, leaping into the air, her sweat showering her audiences. Her brand of country was deemed, quote, cowpunk, and appealed to alternative crowds who favored the new wave and rockabilly scenes. She would dial down the intensity of her live shows and aesthetic by the time she put out 1988's Shadowland, her third studio album, but first as a solo artist. She enlisted producer Owen Bradley, a major force behind the 1950s and 60s Nashville country sound, who worked with the likes of Loretta Lynn, Brenda Lee, Conway Twitty, and Lang's idol, Patsy Cline. The album was well received and hit number 9 on Billboard's top country album charts, while its song, I'm Down to My Last Cigarette, became Lang's first to grace the top country singles chart. After appearing on Johnny Carson's Tonight Show for the fourth time in a little more than a year, and making a fantastically bizarre cameo on Pee-wee's Playhouse Christmas special, please Google it, the singer went on to bag 3 Grammy nominations, 2 for songs from Shadowland, and 1 for her sterling duet with Roy Orbison on a remake of his classic track, Crying. She walked home with the last award, her first Grammy win. She also won Best Female Country Vocalist and Female Vocalist of the Year at the Juno Awards, considered the highest honors in Canada's music industry. But Lang's music wasn't storming country airwaves. and she didn't feel her first three albums truly expressed her vision. She set out to capture it with her fourth, Absolute Torch and Twang, reuniting with the Reclines and bringing in musicians Ben Mink and Greg Penny to co-produce with her. The album earned her a bigger audience and another Grammy for Best Female Country Vocal Performance. Crowds flocked to her shows, raving about a sold-out performance at New York's Beacon Theater, during which the audience cheered Lang into doing five encores. One journalist declared, quote, "Those who witnessed it were baptized. Katie is God." But even after all this success in the U.S. and Canada, Lang just wasn't getting the radio play she needed. Furthermore, Nashville's highly influential Country Music Association never recognized Lang with nominations for any of its general awards. A CMA is country music's Grammy, and a nom would have signaled that she had garnered the respect of her country peers. Some conjecture that her kitschy and over-the-top style shows and videos didn't land with country purists, that they weren't sure if she was serious about the genre or satirizing it as some sort of comedy routine or performance art. Shayna Golden Pershbacher is a professor of music studies at Temple University and the author of the 2022 book Queer Country, which examines queer and trans performers in country and Americana music. She's taken a deep dive into Katie Lang's journey, exploring her offbeat approach to country and how her wild, outsized persona left many suspicious.
You know, dancing in a kind of like exuberant and very gender non-normative, almost like so earnest that it was dorky. And people thought that she was maybe, she didn't really love country music. She was making fun of it. And so journalists from the time would challenge her on that. Like, do you have an honest relationship to country music? They questioned her on that.
Or maybe it was the fact that she was a woman in a male-dominated industry, not to mention a strong, confident woman who looked like a man in a male-dominated industry. Whatever the reasons, Lang hadn't elicited the sort of exposure and adulation needed to propel her to the next level of stardom. By 1990, Lang was exhausted trying to prove herself to Nashville. She was already on the verge of finally throwing in her cowboy hat, but her involvement in PETA's Meat Stinks campaign may have been the nail in the coffin. A passionate vegetarian, Lang endorsed the animal rights group by appearing in a video in which she hugged a tan cow named Lulu on a retirement ranch for aging animals. "We all love animals, but why do we call some pets and some dinner?" she asked in the ad. "If you knew how meat was made, you'd probably lose your lunch. I know. I'm from cattle country. That's why I became a vegetarian. Meat stinks, and not just for animals, but for human health and the environment." After PETA invited Entertainment Tonight to the video's filming, the peg being that it was the first ever vegetarian commercial, it quickly gained traction. Most publicity it got was negative. Lang pissed off folks back home, including the Canadian Cattlemen's Association, who railed against her in the press. Several country radio stations in Nebraska, Kansas, Missouri, Montana, Wyoming, and her homeland of Alberta banned her music, claiming she was hurting the livelihood of its listeners. The boycotting took a nasty turn when the "Home of Katie Lang" sign on the edge of Consort was covered in "I Love Alberta Beef" stickers and spray painted over with the words, "Eat beef, dyke." Reflecting on the Meat Stinks backlash, Lang later told Victoria Starr, author of the 1994 biography, "Katie Lang, All You Get Is Me," quote, "I think that in some ways people were waiting for something to attack me on. I just thank God that it was something I truly believe in." Soon after the PETA debacle, Lang decided she was done playing the game. She was an androgynous outlaw who believed in her art, and she'd shaken the Nashville tree as much as she could. Says Shayna Golden Pershbacher,
she realized that she was never going to make it after that, that, you know, those doors were closed to her.
Lang had crossed her threshold of patience. It was time to walk away from country and explore new horizons. Speculation about Lang's sexual orientation had been swirling for years, but if she had built up a fervent lesbian fan base, flirting with and teasing her audiences, she'd never come out publicly. When journalist Connie Chung interviewed her for her CBS show in the fall of 1989, probing her about her gender-bending appearance and asking her about marriage, Lang suavely danced around the topic before evading it completely with a simple quote, "Let's change the subject." But the subject of queer love would be front and center on Lang's next record. When she set out to make her 1992 pop crossover Ingenue, she was heartbroken. She'd fallen for a married woman, but her affection was not reciprocated. She couldn't dance around that. Unrequited desire dominated her thoughts. This woman had blown up her life. She had to pick up the pieces. Lang couldn't rely on Patsy Cline mimicry or winking stage antics to communicate this kind of despair. She had to look inward. Now that she'd abandoned Nashville, she also knew her next record was a chance to reset and experiment. If there were ever a time to clean the slate, it was now. Lang again called on Ben Mink and Greg Penny to co-produce. Their influences spanned genres and decades. Ingenue had shades of the polished production of Shadowland, but it was more than that, evoking not only Patsy Cline, but torch singer Julie London, jazz, cabaret, and Moroccan Middle Eastern and Eastern European music. Somehow, Lang, Mink, and Penny managed to avoid an everything but the kitchen sink sound. The word I always use when talking about Ingenue is restraint. Lang's honeyed, show-stopping vocals and the album's eclectic mix of instruments, mandolins, clarinets, marimbas, pizzicato violins, lent it an elegant, worldly vibe, but the architects behind it knew when to trim the fat. The negative space between these elements was as important as the music itself. Ingenue breathes, like Lang must have, after exercising her demons while making it. Mink and Lang referred to Ingenue as, quote, post-nuclear cabaret, which was essentially an amalgamation of whatever they were listening to at the time. Mink, for example, was in a klezmer band playing Eastern European music, a big part of his heritage. While they were sifting through his family photographs for inspiration, one in particular stood out to Lang. In it, Mink's parents, who were Holocaust survivors, were shown celebrating the end of World War II, surrounded by bottles of wine and a group of revelers. Ben Mink recalled the significance of the photo to me.
It was a year after my parents were liberated from the camps, and they're sitting around at a table with their friends getting drunk. And there's an accordion player, violin player. You know, it was really inspirational because it was that kind of Kurt Weill cabaret feeling. And, you know, we talked about it and said, you know, that's just a wonderful place to be. Whatever happens in your life.
Yes, Ingenue and its lead single, Constant Craving, were about the pain of unconsummated love. But the music also embodied a larger theme of the human condition. As Mink explains, it was about resilience and survival.
So I think the album itself had a very bittersweet quality. You know, even Constant Craving is really about the struggle and all that. But, you know, hang in there. There's another side to it. We have to keep going. You know, I saw it in many ways as kind of a reference and a tribute to what my personal history was. The instrumentation, the music, the sentiment. And KD had a different take on it. And the two attitudes blended really, really beautifully. So, and with a singer like that, you know, how do you lose? She's one of the great voices of the century.
Post-nuclear, then, was more than a dramatic term for recovering from heartache.
So post-nuclear, you know, was really about, I think, the idea that everyone interprets the stresses and the pain they've had. There's a moment of celebration after that. And it's that feeling where you're still feeling the pain and the acid and all the horrible stuff, but you're trumpeting, you know, a forward positive movement.
With Ingenue, Lang and her co-producers weren't chasing trends. In fact, Lang wanted to steer clear of what she considered a new overproduced sound of music in which the vocals sometimes felt secondary to the percussion. But going against the grain was audacious. Says Mink,
I knew that if it didn't work, my career, as I knew it, was pretty much done. You know, having Torch and Twang as a Grammy album just before it, you know, people were listening. And if it bombed, I was going to be singled out.
Lang, too, felt exposed and nervous.
She was scared for the follow-up. We were, you know, any album is going to be nerve-wracking for a performer to get in, you stick your neck out. But this was such a risk, you know. Sonically, it was like nothing else we had done and not like anything else most people have done.
Lang had been living in L.A., but in the fall and winter of 1991, the crew hunkered down in a rented house in Vancouver to write and record the demos. The track that would become the album's biggest hit and Lang's calling card was its first single, Constant Craving. Originally titled Easter Passover, because both holidays fell on the day it was written, the song distills the spirit of Ingenue into an exquisite 4.5 minutes. You'd be hard-pressed to name even 5 pop songs featuring accordion, but this one uses the instrument to remarkable, haunting effect. It's the track's connective tissue. Because of this accordion, the world seems to stop for me whenever the song comes on, in a car, or in the grocery store, in a doctor's office. It feels ancient, intrinsic, primal. Paired with that guitar strumming, which was just country enough to nod to Lang's roots, and those slinky vibraphones that conjure images of a smoky jazz club and some film noir, it seems to echo the sentiment of the song. Constant Craving, like Desire, feels timeless. But Lang originally hated it. She and Mink wrote the music first, but Lang struggled to write the lyrics, literally banging her head against a typewriter for a few days before finally coming up with the words Constant Craving. Even then, they sounded awkward. She said that a lot of people thought she was singing God Sent Gravy. As Ben Mink explains, she thought the track sounded too poppy and commercial compared to the rest of Ingenue, which was slow-burning and moody. But Mink and Penny believed in Constant Craving and were determined to make it work. After retracking the guitars in a different key and ditching a third verse Lang was struggling to write for a twangy electric guitar solo, they were able to persuade the singer to record it. The recording process was painful for Lang in more ways than one. Not only did she have to resuscitate and relive her personal anguish, but she found herself straining to hit the notes. Panic sank in when she realized they may have to scrap the whole project, that she may have lost her greatest gift. It turned out that she had an infected tooth pushing on her eustachian tube, which affected her hearing and pitch. Only after having a root canal could she deliver the goods. When Ingenue came out in March 1992, initial reviews were mixed. Ben Mink still recalls one particularly brutal one.
We had a review in People magazine that was horrible, and it singled me out. It said, KD, next time Ben comes knocking on your door, bar it. Like, don't let him in. I mean, you know, you got everyone who you went to school with reading this article, and you're going, how am I going to live this down? But, you know, it changed. It changed very quickly. There was a lot of controversy about the record. Is it good or is it terrible? And when that happens, that's a good thing. What you don't want is complacency.
The negative reviews were quickly eclipsed by the record sales, its lead singles, airplay, and the accolades that followed. Constant Craving became Lang's biggest hit to date, reaching number 2 on the Adult Contemporary chart and number 38 on the Billboard Hot 100. The album went double platinum and in 1993 earned a Grammy nomination for Album of the Year. Constant Craving also received nods for both Song and Record of the Year and one for Best Female Vocal Performance. Despite that adult contemporary label, the single also seemed to resonate with a younger audience. Lang was shocked when its video, a gorgeous black and white recreation of the 1953 Paris premiere of the Samuel Beckett play Waiting for Godot, won Best Female Video at the 1993 MTV Video Music Awards. As its name suggests, Ingenue was about going back to basics, employing old sounds and fresh ways to tell a familiar story. Love can turn us all into children. Exploring another more vulnerable side of herself on the album was a dicey enough move for Lang. But in June of 1992, just 3 months after the release of Ingenue, just as she was gaining credibility in the pop landscape, she would take the biggest risk of her career. She would finally discuss her sexuality publicly. The Advocate, one of the oldest and most widely circulated LGBTQ magazines, had been trying to book an interview with Lang for years, going through her label Sire, which was part of Warner Brothers, and even through her friends. But she proved elusive. She knew speaking with the publication and not addressing her sexuality would be disingenuous, but she also hadn't been ready to go there. When the editors contacted Sire in the spring of 1992 and explained they wanted Lang to be the cover story for their issue unveiling the magazine's new redesign, her PR team seemed interested, but then gave them the runaround. When they finally got the call in May, Sire informed the editors they could interview Lang in the UK, where she was about to launch the tour for Ingenue. The magazine tried to secure a female journalist for the story, thinking Lang would feel more comfortable opening up, but no lesbian writers were free to fly to Europe on such short notice. The editors finally secured Brendan Lemon, a gay editor at The New Yorker, who would eventually become the editor-in-chief of Out Magazine, the Advocate's entertainment-focused sister brand. He met Lang in London, where, to his surprise, she came to pick him up at his hotel. He was immediately won over by her warmth, candor, and sense of humor. At a table in a small cafe, they had lunch, but Lemon wasn't sure he'd get to talk to her about her private life until late in the interview. They discussed her inspiration for the album, her childhood memories, and the PETA controversy. But then, after Lemon asked her about making fun of speculation surrounding her sexual orientation on stage, she finally admitted that she didn't want to be out in a major way. When Lemon asked why not, Lang replied, "Because that's not the thing to me. I don't feel political about my preference." She continued, "There should be strong examples in the subculture, and I think there should be people fighting for our rights. But I don't feel like it's my passion. It certainly isn't my cause." She made it clear that she'd never denied or tried to hide her queerness. Lemon then said, "I think the danger for you is that there's going to be a point at which you just don't want to hedge anymore, and you say, 'Let me come out and then go on with my life as an artist.'" To which Lang replied, "Well, I think I'm at that point." When those words appeared in print weeks later, Lang became one of the only openly lesbian celebrities, and certainly the most famous lesbian pop singer. Whether or not she wanted to be an icon or a role model, she was now. I asked Lemon why Katie Lang chose to come out in The Advocate and not in a television interview, like the one she'd done with Connie Chung 3 years before.
I think KD felt if she came out in a place like The Advocate, she would be speaking to a readership that would understand her. I think she had been asked about it for so long that she finally wanted to do it and just get it behind her. At the same time, I think she did want to do it in print because it would allow her to talk with more nuance and complexity about the issues of sexuality, which would have been much harder for her to do on television. And to a certain extent, more difficult for her to do in a large mainstream publication like People, because People would have put on its cover line, you know, Katie Lang comes out. The Advocate didn't do that. So I think Katie realized that she wouldn't be sensationalized if she came out in The Advocate, but she would feel sensationalized if she came out in, certainly on television, and even in somewhere like People.
In her Advocate interview, Lang expressed that what scared her most about coming out publicly was hurting her mother. But she admitted that she also worried about saying the wrong things and hurting her culture. Still, she seemed to recognize that the personal is political. Or at least now, when she looks back, she better understands that her motives extended beyond her just wanting to put the rumors to rest. In a recent ABC Radio National interview, Lang said of her coming out, quote, "It felt like it was a necessity, because homophobia was rampant at that time due to the AIDS crisis. And I felt like a really personal commitment to the importance of coming out at that time and giving a voice and a recognizable image to a culture that had been demonized at that time." Lang knew what was at stake. Her relationships with her family, bandmates, fans, peers, the recording academy, whatever connection she still had with Nashville. But she'd reached a crossroads where secrecy no longer felt like an option. As Brendan Lemon explained,
you know, when Katie's doing this, she's taking a big risk with her career. She has finally, you know, a hit single with Constant Craving off the Ingenue album. And she has finally getting some sales and some attention. Now, most artists, that's the very moment at that time when they aren't going to jeopardize that by coming out. That's going to be the moment where they're not going to do that. But that was the moment when Katie did do that. So I think she felt if she were going to do it, it had to be done with integrity. I always knew that for her, it was the music that mattered the most. And that was why she wasn't afraid to come out and to endure or to experience whatever was going to come out as a follow-up.
The music was paramount. Lang still had a record and tour to promote, audiences to enrapture, more songs to write. So after her big moment, she got back to work with her token sense of humor. as she teased at one performance. Now, you all know the rumors that have been circulating in the press. Pause. And I have to say it's true. It's true. I am a Lawrence Welk fan. Meanwhile, many, including her producer and former bandmate Ben Mink, didn't think her revelation was all that shocking.
But is it really a surprise, you know, at all of it? I mean, who didn't know? You know, I remember we once did this, it's a very funny story. We did it was a private show for Warner Brothers acts and their executives somewhere. And Aerosmith were just doing their comeback. And so we were on this little tiny show where we'd each do like four songs, and Aerosmith was there and KD was there and probably a couple of us. But afterwards, you know, Steve Tyler has just seen KD perform for the first time. And he comes over to me, we're standing at the side of the stage, and he goes, "Man, she can sing." He goes, "You think she'd sing 'Dude Looks Like a Lady' with me?" But, you know, it was no secret. I mean, you saw her and you kind of knew what was going on. So I guess the coming out, it was just an official statement.
Coming out officially changed everything for Lang. She was celebrated, but also scrutinized, suddenly becoming fodder for gossip columnists and tabloids. Was she dating Liza Minnelli or Sandra Bernhard? Prince collaborator Wendy Melvoin? Or tennis player Martina Navratilova? Or Madonna, who once said of a Lang performance, "Elvis is alive and she is ever beautiful." But that was just chatter. Lang posed with Cindy Crawford on that Vanity Fair cover and racked up the sales and the trophies. At the 1993 Grammys, after winning Best Female Vocal Performance, she said to reporters, "What could I possibly do to top this? Best male vocalist?" Pop's most famous androgyne was still self-aware, still in on the joke. As Lang recalled to The Guardian in 2017, "The previous year, there was a huge backlash when I did a Meat Stinks campaign for PETA. But by the time I came out, I think people had exhausted all their anger and hate for me. When we were nominated for the Grammys, there were religious groups outside picketing, but it wasn't too bad." Lang would never have another hit like Constant Craving. She would fade from the mainstream spotlight as the 90s drew to a close, partly by choice. Fame was too much for her, a theme she explored on Ingenue's 1995 follow-up, All You Can Eat. But her albums continued to sell, and she remained an in-demand musician, recording and touring with Tony Bennett in 2002, and winning another Grammy for their collaborative album, A Wonderful World. She sang on Disney's Home and the Range soundtrack. She performed at the Olympics opening ceremony in 2010 and was inducted into the Canadian Music Hall of Fame in 2013. Today, Lang cooks, practices Buddhism, spends time with her partner, and lies pretty low. As she told The Guardian in 2019, "I grew up with the adage that there is a wealth of purpose in being mysterious. And I feel like I haven't had the chance to be mysterious. My sexuality and everything was so much out in the open and has been for many years. I feel exhausted by being exposed. And it's truly not that interesting." If Lang recently said she's taking a break from music, that her days of writing new material may be over, Ingenue remains a pop culture touchstone, part of the singer-songwriter canon. Says its co-producer Ben Mink,
"I wouldn't go so far as to say it invented a genre. I think that the genre was kind of there, but what it did was there was a certain kind of coffee house jazz cabaret thing that sort of fueled artists like Nora Jones and Feist. It definitely created a certain kind of singer-songwriter folk jazz style that became acceptable."
And though she was a reluctant hero, Lang coming out when she did changed the conversation. Other celebrities would follow. Melissa Etheridge, Ellen DeGeneres, Rosie O'Donnell. In the late 1990s, Will and Grace would premiere and become a hit. Says Brendan Lemon,
"I think she's definitely a trailblazer. I think even with all of the queerness in pop music before 1992, she was still one of the very first people in the media spotlight at that particular moment who came out. So I think in that sense, she's very significant.
Next up, after the break, the story of another pop music trailblazer, one who was ready to discuss her sexuality out the gate, Sophie B. Hawkins, whose breakthrough single, Damn I Wish I Was Your Lover, became an inescapable anthem for the lovesick and the horny, and who, like Lang, was a singer-songwriter who fought to maintain her integrity and autonomy in an industry that didn't always understand her.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Sophie B. Hawkins didn't have a conventional adolescence. She grew up in New York City, where her mother was a fiction writer and her father was a lawyer. She attended the Manhattan School of Music, but left to pursue drumming, moving in with a Nigerian percussionist, Babatunde Elatunji, and a group of musicians when she was 14. She and Elatunji, who was about 50 at the time, had what she calls an amazing, passionate, very difficult, but very strong relationship until she was 20. She studied jazz and African and Brazilian music, learning to play the vibraphone and marimbas and a Casio keyboard, eventually touring as a percussionist with Roxy Music's Brian Ferry before she got fired. She initially aspired to be, quote, the greatest drummer ever, she says, but soon concluded she needed another outlet to express herself, so she took up songwriting. Hawkins recalls finishing the first version of her 1992 hit, Damn, I Wish I Was Your Lover, in 1988, when she was in her mid-20s. She wrote it in the Upper West Side apartment she grew up in, and a $300 piano she'd purchased when she decided to move beyond a career in percussion. At that point, she was working at Coat Checks and as a waitress, subletting apartments all over Manhattan, then crashing back at her parents' when her leases were up. She was also acting and doing performance art at spaces like PS 122 and singing in gospel choirs in Harlem. Music was her life. Much like how Katie Lang kept her love interest at the center of Ingenue's secret, Hawkins won't reveal the identity of the person who inspired Damn, I Wish I Was Your Lover. But play the song once, and it's obvious she'd fallen hard. I give you something sweet each time you come inside my jungle book. What is it, just too good, she sings. Don't say you'll stay, because then you'll go away. When we spoke about the genesis of the single, she said she knew she had something almost immediately.
I just knew it by the chords. I knew the minute that my fingers slipped and I did that chord progression, and it was, you know, that sound of the verse, you know, the da da with a D over G. I thought, oh, this is beautiful. This is big. I don't know how that knew that. I thought this is the one I've been waiting for, and this is scary. I remember looking out the window. I said, now here comes the one you've been waiting for. What are you going to do with it?
She worked on the track for another couple of weeks, building on it that summer on her aunt's piano in Cape Cod. Writing it was an act of catharsis, at once terrifying and liberating.
So I was taking the risk of opening up my heart or pursuing a person and getting involved in relationships, you know, in the downtown art scene that I knew were dangerous and explosive and creative. But I also knew I had to open up and get to the goods inside of me.
Hawkins confirms that Damn, I Wish I Was Your Lover is about longing and lust, but she hesitates to elaborate on the story behind it. Family, alcoholism, abuse. She says it's a big mix of pain and passion, a tale of breaking through barriers and finding one's agency. Its core line, free your mind and you won't feel ashamed, may have been delivered to an object of desire, but it's just as much a mantra for anyone coming to terms with their identity, sexual or otherwise. Hawkins had a very clear idea of what she wanted for her debut album, Tongues and Tales, and it hardly fit in with the music dominating airwaves at the time. While making the record, she says, she fought all the time with producer Ralph Schuckett, who tried to sand off the album's edges to achieve a more mainstream sound. Schuckett had discovered her, seeing the potential of a tape full of demos she'd given him while she was working at a coat check, and had her best interest in mind, knowing what a record label would want to hear. But she was adamant about keeping her vision intact.
I fought all the time with Ralph, but it was a healthy, healthy fighting because he insisted I'd be more pop or more pop rock or this or that. And I just insisted, no, I'm going to be like Pink Floyd meets Motown meets soul. That's who I am. I'm gospel soul, Pink Floyd, Motown. Boom.
Luckily, the album's other producer, Rick Chertoff, who'd produced Cyndi Lauper's debut album, She's So Unusual, shared her vision. He and Hawkins both wanted lush, dark synthesizers that evoked Pink Floyd's Wish You Were Here. He liked Hawkins' backing vocals and drum machines. He also brought in drummer and programmer Sandy Marandino, who folded a sample of Led Zeppelin's When the Levee Breaks into the song. The alchemy of that killer sample, those watery synths, Hawkins' sensual and lovelorn lyrics, and her intoxicating gravelly vocals, which called to mind Chrissy Hynde, Stevie Nicks, and Ricky Lee Jones, resulted in a worldwide smash. Damn, I Wish I Was Your Lover soared to number 5 on the Billboard Hot 100 charts, with Billboard calling it, quote, an unlikely anthem. A review from Entertainment Weekly read, Hawkins says those words as insouciantly as if she'd just broken a nail, but she still lets you know they mean a hell of a lot more than that. And People Magazine declared, when a record opens with a song called Damn, I Wish I Was Your Lover, you realize immediately you're not dealing with some delicate flower. Hawkins knows what she wants, and she knows how to get it. Okay, so I was a kid when I first heard the song, and maybe that's why it sounded like a revolution. But then again, it was a revolution, at least for Top 40 radio. To hear Damn in a chorus, especially such a big, assertive, infectious chorus like this one, was a bit shocking. Songs with curse words, even Damn, the most G-rated of expletives, didn't exist in pop. And Hawkins sings it again and again, emphatically. The word sticks out and hooks you like a nail in a floorboard. She is also at one point so bowled over by her unreciprocated affection that she resorts to the even quainter, dusty, faux curse word, shucks. It's ridiculous. In a very charming early 90s kind of way. As Hawkins said in an interview with American Songwriter, I wasn't in any relationship that was as sophisticated as the song, but I had been triggered by a lot of emotional events to bring the song out of me. There are times when you write a song and you think that it's okay and it's fun to play, people like it, whatever. But then there are the times when a song comes out where you feel like it's almost ugly. It's almost excruciatingly uncomfortable to listen to, but yet you're compelled. Those are the good songs. Damn, I Wish I Was Your Lover is one of those songs. Awkward yet undeniable, goofy yet nerve-tingling. Sort of like the sex Hawkins is chasing after. The sex we're all chasing after. However, even more shocking than Hawkins' use of damn is the fact that the song that most certainly deals with same-sex attraction, at least partly, skirted by so many listeners, including me. Well, she keeps the target of her lust and fascination ambiguous for most of the track, using you and your. She shifts to the third person in its third verse, offering the evocative lines, "I sat on the mountainside with peace of mind. I lay by the ocean making love to her with visions clear. Walked for days with no one near." That was some blatantly homoerotic stuff. And risky, especially then. And yet, I don't recall any major backlash or wisecracks. Yeah, I was probably too young and like many others, distracted by the swearing and those lush synthesizers to pick up on all the lyrics, but the song was everywhere. You gotta remember, this was 1992, when we had only one openly queer female musician on the airwaves, the newly out Katie Lang. Hawkins had her own coming out that year, but it went down a little differently than Lang's. In April of 1992, right after Damn I Wish I Was Your Lover was released, and just weeks before her debut album Tongues and Tails dropped, she described herself as omnisexual in a story for the New York Times. She thinks she actually coined the term. As she explained during the interview, "Most songs that are coming out lately say, 'I'm a man, you're a woman, it's black and white.' But it's so hard to deal with life that way. There are many things that humans can do to transform themselves, and sex is one of the biggest things. I learned all the things I am by being who I wasn't supposed to be, playing all the roles I wasn't supposed to play. Before I allowed myself to be manly sexually, I was embarrassed by being womanly. Now I find it really fun to be everything, and it depends on who brings what out of me." I'll say it again. This was some risky stuff for 1992. Hawkins may have had a hit on her hands, and she'd go on to have a couple of others with her second album, Whaler. But she hardly had an easy ride. Her relationship with Sony, who owned Columbia Records, her label at the time, was tumultuous. Much like Lang, she was laser-focused and unapologetic about her persona and her artistry. Like Lang, she fought against the establishment, but because of it, her career took a beating. Up next, after the break, we'll hear from Sophie B. Hawkins herself about her battle to realize her vision, navigate the music industry, and find her place in the LGBTQ community.
Today, I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm JB Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks,
Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cash back on purchases. And pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Sophie B. Hawkins scored a big hit with Damn, I Wish I Was Your Lover, a song that would become a 90s radio staple and queer canon. But she fought nearly every step of the way to maintain her voice and autonomy. She fought to preserve her production choices on her debut album, Tongues and Tails, resisting suggestions to adhere to traditional pop and rock formulas. She argued to leave her middle initial in her name. The B is for Ballantine, but she joked with the New York Times in 1992 that, quote, the B stands for independence. She pushed to keep Damn in the title of her debut album's lead single. She also urged listeners to reconsider their preconceived notions of gender and sexuality, name-dropping Kate Bornstein's seminal queer and trans book Gender Outlaw in interviews. And finally, when the original video for Damn, I Wish I Was Your Lover was deemed too racy to air on MTV, she fought to promote the single by shooting a tamer and, it must be noted, less inspired video. I caught up with Hawkins to discuss the making of Damn, I Wish I Was Your Lover and the aftermath of its release. So you've said that the meaning of Damn, I Wish I Was Your Lover has changed over time, but what was it about then in 1992 when it came out?
It was about the feelings in the moment of trying to find words to describe the feelings I had for this person. Damn, I Wish I Was Your Lover is true. This person, you know, I'd rock you till the daylight comes. This person is in a situation. They need help. They need enlightenment. They need love and warmth. They need to know that I'm here, willing to go to the ends of the earth of their inside, like the inside journey with them. And here I am. I'm going to open up my heart in. I'm just riffing right now. I don't know. But it was like a really wanting to communicate to this person how much they got to my inside heart. Here's my story to prove it.
Was this person a woman?
Even if I tell you the gender, you have to remember that I'm the one who coined the word omnisexual.
Yep.
So the gender is not going to be so material as we think. And it really is not material. The older I get, the more I realize that, I mean, who knows if it was a woman or a man at this time anyway? Who knows what they thought they were?
I'm wondering what the reaction was around you to the song from executives, from, you know, radio stations and your peers. You know, did anyone push back or were you surprised by the reactions you received?
Yeah, people did. No, Sony had a lot of people. Sony is a big word for a lot of different people. But first of all, Damn wasn't acceptable. They did not want me to sing Damn. They didn't want the third verse, you know, where I'm singing about, you know, making love to her on the ocean. They didn't want any of that. And Sony was incredibly angry when I came out and said I was omnisexual. So there was some fear and everything. And maybe, you know, maybe for me, I grew up in New York City and my mother is a writer, and she wrote a very racy book about two women. So maybe for me, it wasn't such a big deal whether it was a woman or a man. But I did notice there was a lot of consternation, and I think that it was something that kept people held back from really promoting me to the hilt, most likely, because that was also a common thing. Like, why aren't they doing more for you? Why aren't they putting more money into the next single? And I think there was totally a backlash in my, because my performances were wild. I had such a lot going on stage. It was fabulous. And I was pro Gender Outlaw, you know, Kate Bornstein, the book Gender Outlaw. I was on pop radio defending trans people, and that trans is completely natural, and that we have to start paying attention to people who feel that they're, you know, locked into the wrong gender. I was out there. For now, I might be considered normal, but this was 30 years ago. I was there saying trans is normal. Being omnisexual is completely normal. I was a pop star. I was fighting on every level for every aspect of my albums, and I always have, and I always will. And then if someone said, you know, are you gay or straight? Does it matter? We'll put more money into you if you're straight. I wouldn't even have, like, honored that. Nobody would have dared come up to me and said that.
So you weren't asked, you know? You weren't asked to stay in the closet.
Well, not directly, but I was punished when I was open.
Meaning you weren't getting the funds and the exposure.
Well, they were angry at me. They were angry, and they were vocally angry at me. And they thought I was uncontrollable and wild, and I would say anything. And, you know, I probably did say some stupid things. I know I did. But they weren't about me. I was almost, I don't know, I was in a state of rebellion because it was very constrictive. The world was very constrictive, and I wanted to burst open and help other people. I saw the response of kids at my shows. I saw the response of the trans community when I would start defending Gender Outlaw, the book. And I wanted to defend people. I wanted to protect the kids. I wanted to be out there and say, we are so much more in the majority than you think. I was so excitedly loving humanity.
So there was something in the ether in 1982, and you were part of this. So I'm wondering, what do you think was going on? Like, what do you think was in the air?
Ah, yes, there was a consciousness shift. Mm-hmm. And it was built really on the shoulders of all these other people. And suddenly, I guess what they say is the 100th monkey. Is that what it is? Mm-hmm. You get to a critical mass, mm-hmm. and things change. But it's not without the incredible work and bravery of the activists who came for, you know, years before us, even hundreds of years. And so I think also when people were reading books like Stone Butch Blues, mm-hmm. and were really understanding and, you know, what happened, how people lived, I think everyone, all of us young people, young folks, we said, wow, our predecessors have fought so hard and suffered so much. We have to just be out and do this. You know, there just comes that point. Isn't it true? And then we had the Reagan era before. In some ways, it's also, like, on the one hand, it's probably this combination of affluence and oppression that makes the young folks get out and say, no more, we're standing for this. We're putting it in our art. It's a renaissance of, you know, whatever. So it's economic, it's political. And AIDS, as you said, when a crisis of that degree happens, people respond by saying no more.
I mean, you were up against so much with the song. You know, you had to fight to keep Damn in the title. You know, the initial video for Damn, I Wish I Was Your Lover was rejected by MTV because you were dancing with a black man in it. And, you know, of course, you know, you've got this sexually ambiguous song that it could be interpreted, you know, as lesbian, homoerotic, depending on, you know, the perspective of the narrator, who the narrator is. I just feel like there was so much pushback from every angle.
I think that whatever the gay mafia was, thought I wasn't gay enough. And I think that that was a something that may not have helped me, was that I wasn't, you know, when I said omnisexual, I wasn't saying lesbian or gay. And I think that there was a big problem with that in the gay community, because at that time they wanted people to come out and say, I'm gay or I'm straight. And they really wanted people who might be gay to be gay. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't, in all honesty, I told you this a little bit of my history. I was young. I was in my 20s. I had spent the greater part of my life with this, in some ways, amazing man, and had, you know, very short but phenomenally passionate relationships with women. And I couldn't really know what I was in the song. And this is what I meant to say, is meant to say, create your own life, create your own roadmap. Don't, like, that's why I think I add all the story in, because when you listen to the story, you don't go, she's one thing or another, and she's telling us to be one thing or another. I think what I'm saying is, what's your story? This is mine. What's your story?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's almost like the community was asking you to, you know, decide, like, either you're with us or you're not with us right now. And, you know, we don't want any gray areas. You know, I think that was partly because there was such an urgency because of the AIDS crisis for people to be out and proud and to fight, you know, for their rights. And I don't think you would have that same sort of
you know, ultimatum today, you could get away with just saying, I'm omnisexual, I don't like labels, I'm LGBTQ. You know, I think it was different then.
I think you're right. And I think, again, that's the highly political nature of where we were in 1992. And it gave some causes fuel because everyone was suddenly so political, but it took away some of the nuances. And I don't think anyone could have ever called me gray. And I say in the song, I'm everything. Mm-hmm. And tonight I'll be your mother. So that's not gray. That's really true as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
And I also believe that we're connected on a soul level. We're in these bodies, but we're not defined by our bodies. I keep trying to say that. That's why I love the trans movement, mm-hmm. because I'm saying if someone is saying they're not defined by what you see, let them say that and let them define themselves. This is the core of being a human, is as having a soul. You find out the voice of your soul, and you're speaking the voice of your soul. You're not speaking the voice of your penis or your vagina, hopefully, or else if you are, that's a boring song.
So would you have done anything differently when this song was blowing up and when your career was blowing up and when you were becoming Sophie B. Hawkins?
Not musically. Musically, I've always been true. But definitely as a self-promoter, I would have done a ton of things differently. I think the weight of my mistakes was really difficult on my career and as on me as an artist. And I just wasn't emotionally developed enough for society in some ways. I was developed so much in the artistic way and in this intimate way, but in terms of dealing with people, I really didn't see and understand a lot. And I made just too many mistakes that were crushing. And if I had had good people around me that really, but you know, if I had, would I have known it? I don't know. It's all the coming from where I came from, you know, coming from where I came from. I did amazingly. It's a miracle. But do I look back on it and wish that I had other tools? Oh God. But you know what? I still have me and I'm still working and I love my new material and I'm still promoting the old material. So I actually have to say, I look at it, but my glass is pretty full.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But yes, I would have saved myself a lot of suffering if I had had if I had more tools, just simply put.
You think when you say tools, do you mean, you know, a better support system or more?
Able to believe in myself in that, like, it's like I would go very, very far, but it would be that last inch. And I think that Sony, and I don't think there's a person who works at Sony who would have said I could have done more. Mm-hmm. They were a pretty tough label, mm-hmm. and they were very hard to deal with and to survive on. And I eventually left, as you know.
Last couple of questions. I wanted to ask you about some of the lyrics as well. Because some of them are really esoteric, just sort of vague. Opaque, you used, I think, is a good word as well. In verse two, you sing, this monkey can't stand to see you black and blue. I give you something sweet each time you come inside my jungle book. What is it? Just too good? Don't say you'll stay, because then you go away. What is this... What's the story with the monkey and the Jungle Book?
Well, the monkey is something that is developing. I can see through my journals.
Uh-huh.
It's sort of a survival technique, I think, in the city and things that were happening around. And I think that the Jungle Book is definitely, you know, Rudyard Kipling, mm-hmm. Mowgli, that I had this image of myself. Again, it's sort of this identity of that's how I will survive. That's how I will remain pure. Remain an untouched, pure child, regardless of all these things that happen, is that I will be Mowgli in the Jungle Book. And I'm inviting this person to come to my least manipulative self, my least manipulative part, is if you can come inside my Jungle Book, where it's a story and it's safe and I can talk to the animals. And it's just like this beautiful, I wasn't aware of it. This is what really comes out of me. That's what came out of me. And people related to it. And I think they related to it on their child self as well. And that's amazing.
Interesting. Yeah. Because I also read it as, and again, open to interpretation, which we've said all along here, I also read it as very, very suggestive. You know, very, very suggestive, very sensual, sexual.
Yes.
Which certainly fits with what this song is about. And then I see at the end, which I'd never heard this bit. This might be sort of as it starts to fade out. Getting on my camel, gonna ride it uptown.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
It's just, you know, then I was just singing improvisationally and getting up. I don't know. I think it's just there must have been something going on in my head with who I was speaking to, you know, who I was singing to.
Yeah.
And again, it could be all the political references, you know, what was going on, Afghanistan, everything. Just trying to maybe bring in a more ancient sense that this is like not in this time.
Yeah.
You know, because I say I'm getting on my subway, then I say I'm getting on my camel. It's like no matter what time we're in, you know, whether it's 4,000 years ago or 5,000 years from now, I'm still going to wish I was your lover.
I love how in discussing her 1992 hit, Sophie B. Hawkins unintentionally summed up another hit single from that year, a little song by her queer contemporary Katie Lang called Constant Craving. That gem also tackled the subject of unrequited romance, and it also drove home the idea that love and lust are innate and eternal, an irrefutable part of the human condition. As Lang sings, "Always someone marches brave here beneath my skin, and constant craving has always been." In that regard, these songs, from albums released within a month of one another, serve as companion pieces. Two tracks became queer anthems, transcending bigotry and homophobia to make stars of the musicians behind them. It's impossible to overstate their significance in a year when most queer artists and performers remained firmly in the closet, some lying not only to their fans and loved ones, but to themselves. In a year when the AIDS crisis was in full swing, becoming the leading cause of death among men between the ages of 25 and 44, and casting a shadow over sexual encounters of any kind. In a year when President George H.W. Bush, in a bid for re-election, toughened his stance on LGBTQ rights, telling the New York Times that he could not accept same-sex parenting as quote-unquote normal. Without trailblazers like Lang and Hawkins, who dared to speak their truth with hopes that others would do the same, we'd likely never have acts like Janelle Monáe, St. Vincent, Kalani, Brandi Carlile, Lil Nas X, Sam Smith, Troye Sivan, Orville Peck, Hayley Kiyoko, King Princess. These are just a handful of LGBTQ musicians who've taken their lead, writing about same-sex love and desire, sharing their tales of pain, yearning, confusion, self-acceptance, celebration, and liberation. They too have forged careers on their own terms, subverting norms and defying expectations. Like Lang and Hawkins before them, they have freed their minds, unashamed to step out of the darkness and into the light. Where Were You in 92 was a production of iHeartRadio. The executive producers are Noel Brown and Jordan Runtog. The show is researched, written, and hosted by me, Jason Lanfier, with editing and sound design by Michael Alder June. If you like what you heard, please subscribe and leave us a review. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, check out the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Hey guys, back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah!
and some waves so we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that.
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in.
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it.
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby.
Wait. Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Do you love fashion? Do you love getting compliments on how well you're dressed? Are you always seeking the latest trends? Then we're talking to you. BostonProper.com is your fashion destination and the only place to go for all those nods, head turns, and new styles. No matter the day, season, or occasion, Boston Proper has what you're looking for. Sophisticated, confident clothing designed to flatter and get noticed. So visit BostonProper.com now and start creating your perfect wardrobe. Boston Proper. Wear it like no one else.